I suppose the old stereotype goes in any given couple, one person is a spender and another is a saver. But what makes financial compatibility? I'm joined on the line now by John Lowe. He's founder and managing director of The Money Doctors. John, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Kira. It's very nice to talk to you again, as always.
Now, financial compatibility, what comprises it?
Well, you know, you're starting to fancy some partner and you're starting to hold hands. And in between where you start holding hands and when you say, I do, somewhere along the lines, you've got to start talking money. You know, generally you might go on a holidays together and you'll probably go Dutch, which you pay for each of your own holidays. But after a while, you're now starting to think as a couple. And so it's really important at that point, whatever that point is, that you actually start talking about money. I mean, I had a couple in recently, and they both had 100,000 debt. They were two medical qualified people.
Yeah.
But they had borrowed 100,000 to get them to where they were. But could you imagine if one said to the other that they didn't have any debt? They suddenly go for it, looking for a mortgage, and they find that they have 100,000 debt. You know, those kind of things, as I said, need to be brought out. And there are a lot of men in particular, I think, are worse at it. You know, they have a credit card they forgot to tell the fiancé about, or they've got, you know, a debt that they've been struggling with, and suddenly they've got a bad record. Because when you go looking for a mortgage, Kira, the first thing the lender's going to do is look at your credit history through ICB, Irish Credit Bureau, or the Central Credit Register, .ie. And they'll tell you everything, whether you've missed one payment. And if you have missed one payment, you can say goodbye to a mortgage application for 5 years.
Wow, I didn't realise it was that long.
Oh, it is. It's 5 years if you've missed one payment. You know, so many people at Christmas, you know, they've got a car loan, for instance, and they say, okay, I tell you what I'll do. I go and make two payments in January, and I won't bother paying the one in December because I need that money to go and buy presents. They don't think that the following month they pay the two payments off, but there's still now one missed payment in December, and it's there for 5 years.
Even though numerically you are where you should be with your schedule.
Yeah, absolutely. You've missed a payment. And even though you're up to date, you still missed a payment. That is a record which stays there for 5 years.
What I always find interesting when you're discussing financial compatibility is how both parties can view money. Because some people view it as a means to an end. Some hoard it if it comes across their path. Some will not spend it for love nor money. And with others, getting rid of it is as easy as breathing.
You're so right. You're absolutely so right. And actually where that influence comes from, Kira, is parents and your background and how you're raised. If you were raised frugally where you watched every penny, it's pretty likely that you're going to stay that way once you get married. And sometimes you can hide that from your partner. And you don't know that you're a miserable so-and-so that you won't spend Christmas. So there's all that to contend with and to let the partner know what kind of person. Because you can, once you know somebody is frugal because of their background, then you can cope with it. Then
yeah, you can work
make
around
allowances.
It.
Yeah, you work around it. Same with savings. You know, people are very shy about maybe saying, well, actually, I've got, you know, a slush fund of, you know, 5 grand, 10,000, and I don't want my partner to know. That's all wrong. That's, you know, you have to start off with trust. Trust is the main thing in any relationship.
Now, there's an old tradition in Ireland, and I would imagine in an awful lot of countries, of having a few bob for running away money. And it doesn't mean you're actually going to run away with the money, but it's a small sum of money you may not necessarily tell anybody about, but you keep it for emergencies, for your own purposes, historically called running away money. And you would say no to that.
I would, because I think it's dishonest in some respects. I do really, really believe, though, in the rainy day fund, Kira, where you have that a rainy day fund for three reasons. One is the emergency. You know, your clutch goes or your washing machine goes. You have to have money straight away. Your sudden loss of income. You know, how many people have either been put on a two-day week or, you know, don't get the bonus this year, no overtime, or even get made redundant. And then the third reason is the investment opportunity. You know, you'll still need 10% for a purchase price, even if you're a first-time buyer. So all of those things, you need that rainy day fund, but you should be doing it together. It's great fun. Actually, I have to say, when I was getting married first, And I mean, after I think 3 months, I'd asked my girlfriend then to marry me, but we didn't get married for 4 years. But during that period, we saved up money so we could buy white goods, washing machine, fridge, cooker. And that was stored away with some company who had it until we found the house, and then we got... But the white goods was really the start of working our finances together.
And the thing about financial compatibility is it's possibly the least sexy and romantic aspect of your relationship, but it is one that will impact your day-to-day relationship.
Oh, gosh, so much, Kira. You know, I mean, I have to say, discussing credit cards and spending habits are not generally on the love agenda when you're starting to date somebody, you know, certainly not at the start. And even then after that, it depends. You know, I'm the old school, by the way. You know, I always believe that if you're going out, you know, cinema, meals, anything, the man always paid, you know, never let the lady pay.
Do you still feel that way?
It will now depend actually on the incomes. Actually, you know, you can have and I did several a huge amount actually where the female is far more remunerated than the male, and therefore has maybe, you know, they could be on 120,000 and the male might be on 40. Well, that's you know, the female there is the main breadwinner, and you know, therefore that, I suppose, philosophy wouldn't apply to that gentleman, because if he hasn't got the money, you know, it wouldn't be expected. But I still think it's a gentlemanly thing. It's a, you know, an aspiration. There's nothing like courtesy and manners, especially, you know, that would be handed down, by the way. Again, it's going back to parents. It's going back to the way you were raised.
So the key elements for financial compatibility, John, would be to be upfront about who you are in terms of money. If you have any debts, if you're a spender, if you're a saver, if you couldn't care less about money, then, you know, hand it all over, obviously, but not completely back off to the person in the household who is better with it.
Yes, and generally, I have to say, it's the fairer kind of gender who actually are better money managers. They're more administratively orientated. And I mean, it is very simple, really. I think it's so important to work out together and sit down, maybe with that bottle of wine, and work out how much does it cost us to run our life on a monthly basis, even care of having children. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you know, when they get married, they don't actually think about the financial aspects of having a child. I mean, your third level education is going to cost you 42,000, but the actual child itself, from start to finish, is actually $250,000.
Yeah, but John, if anybody actually sat down and went, darling, will we have children? It's going to cost us $250,000 per child. Sure, nobody would do it.
Well, my mother would have agreed with you completely, because she had 8 of them. And we didn't have $250,000 each, I can tell you. You know, there's no one great one-liner. We were so poor here. The first time I saw a butcher shop, I thought there was an accident.
Well, John Lowe, founder and managing director of The Money Doctors, always a pleasure. Thank you indeed for joining us. I'm interested in what you might think of John's views on that. The gentleman should always pay, or pay most of the time, even if you've been married for 30 years. And also running away money. He says it's a little dishonest. 0833 97 97 97. Our own Pat Costello is continuing his tour of County Kildare, his grand tour. Pat, where do we find you this afternoon?
Well, I might be a little bit, maybe a day early, Ciara, but I'm at the Curragh. I'm at the Curragh because, of course, it is the Dubai duty-free derby weekend here, and I'm talking to Evan Arkwright. Evan, 20 years in the business here in the Curragh. It's, I suppose, a derby weekend of a difference.
It has, yeah. I've seen a lot of great derbies here, Pat, over the years. Some great horses winning it, some great occasions, some fine weather and some bad weather. We've had everything thrown at us. This year now is very different, but at least it's better than last year. We had no public here last year. We were completely behind closed doors. This year, at least, we're, as part of the government test events, we have 1,000 members of the public here, and that will make a massive difference.
Yeah, how successful was that distribution of tickets? Because I know you were very keen to make sure locals got some tickets.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a no-brainer that obviously we needed to put the local community and frontline workers very much foremost in our thoughts. And 200 tickets were allocated to locals, which was great. And then obviously our own members and sponsors, frontline workers. And then, you know, there's about €10,000 from the contribution from tickets is going to the Peter McVerry Trust. So €10 for every ticket that was, of all the 1,000 tickets that were purchased, is going to Peter McVerry Trust. So that's important to acknowledge that as well, you know.
And that's a local charity here as well, doing an awful lot of work in Kildare. I was on a Zoom call there earlier, name dropping now, with Richard Hannon and who else was there? Pat Coe, the CEO, was there, and Johnny Murtha. Pat Coe was telling us that fully sponsored and huge prize money.
Yeah, massive pot, 2.3 million in prize money between our sponsors, and Horse Racing Ireland has done a really good job. The important thing is to have high prize money to get the best horses. The Derby, the Dubai GTV Irish Derby, is worth 1 million this year, and we've got a fantastic field. Probably one of the most competitive derbies for many, many, many years. Of course, locals will be rooting for Johnny Murtha. Johnny is absolutely an institution, obviously, around here. Trains here on the Curragh, his family, born and bred, involved in so much to do with the local community, including Milltown GA, as probably many of your listeners will know. He'd be a very popular winner. He's ridden the winner four times. This is his first runner, and the horse has a big chance. Glenn Davis, who's Welsh, actually lives here on the Curragh as well, so it would be a great local success, and he's ridden by only and Ben Cohen, who's only 19 years old.
Yeah, a great rider as well. I know you mentioned Johnny, but there are other Kildare trainers who would be involved all over the weekend. Dennis Cullen will be involved tomorrow night, so too will Willie McCreary over the 3 days. Andrew Kinnearns, Prendergast will be there as well. Loads of locals, and of course Jessica.
Yeah, absolutely. We're absolutely, I mean, 3 days racing. Obviously we kick off tomorrow, as you said, the Bournemouth Recycling Apprentice Derby is the big feature. All the future stars of racing, including Annalise Cullen, as you said yourself, she's a real star of the future. Some great racing Friday, and then we move into Derby Day Saturday, and then the As Was Me Pretty Polly Stakes is the big feature on Sunday. But yeah, all the local trainers, all the local jockeys are well represented, and even the local breeders. And just to acknowledge Mojo Star, who's one of the favourites, so second in the Epsom Derby for the Richard Hannon horse, was bred by Barbara Prendergast, who's from just outside Cara. Big day for her, a small breeder, and it's nice to see some of the smaller owners and breeders are going to be involved in this year's Dubai Duty Free Irish Derby.
And finally, Evan, I'll be heading back into the square very, very shortly. It's all festooned with paraphernalia to do with the festival or with the derby. It's important to keep it local.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And we've done, I'm very much involved in the Kildare Derby Festival. Have a great committee, which is chaired by Orla Murtha, Johnny's wife, and we've obviously had to make changes this year because some of the events have going off virtual. We've had so there's lots of podcasts have been going out on the various shows and channels, but we've got this fantastic museum that Jim Kavanagh has coordinated in the old courthouse, which is open to the public. As I said, the square is festooned with all sorts of paraphernalia and memorabilia. It's great stuff. So it's important because next year's Kildare Derby Festival will be particularly important. Hopefully we'll have the crowds back and the square in Kildare will be heaving with people.
Our interview, Evan, might have been more of a 3 miler than a 7 4 long sprint, but we really enjoyed it. The very best of luck for the weekend.
Thanks so much, Pat, and thanks to KFM for all the support as always.
Well done, Evan. That's Evan Arkwright. We're heading across the city, no, across the town very shortly. We're talking to Johnny Crofton, who played fullback for Kildare in his day, and we'll be back at the square. Oh, we're looking forward to the whole afternoon.
Great stuff, Pat. We'll check in with Pat a little bit later. Now, there is a formal pilot of the concept of a 4-day working week, and it's being trialled by a number of businesses over the course of the next 6 months. Employers group IBEC says, however, the initial proposal, which is co-funded by government, is not realistic. To find out why and how IBEC think this way, I'm joined on the line by its Director of Employer Relations, Maeve McAwee. Maeve, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara.
What's wrong with this initial proposal from your perspective?
Well, actually, probably maybe just to put a bit of context around this, for lots of organisations, it may well actually be a great opportunity to introduce flexibility into the business. I think it's probably more that as a one-size-fits-all, it would be prohibitive for many businesses to be able to do it. But as with all flexibilities, depending on the needs of the business, the needs of the service users, customers and clients and so on, different types of flexibility will be more appealing and more available depending on the context in which a business is operating.
And I think that that's a really key point, because there are some businesses, some sectors of the economy in which this will not work at all. There are others which will be able to onboard a four-day working week with relative ease. And there are a lot of companies, I would imagine, Maeve, where some members of the workforce can do, because of the kind of work they're engaged in, a four-day week, but their colleagues cannot.
Yes, exactly. So there's an enormous mix of considerations for any organisation that's looking at flexibility within their business. So everything from the demographic of your organisation, the needs of your service or clients, but also the needs of people who are working within the business. So for some people, it might be a very appealing opportunity. For others, it just won't suit the way that they work. They might not like to work in that sort of very intensive environment of all of their productivity in a much shorter period of time, and actually work much better over a five-day work week. Then there are issues such as, you know, the fact that businesses have peaks and troughs. Mm. So, you know, you have periods of the business which can be very intensive and others which are possibly not relaxed, but maybe less pressured. Mm. And the four-day work week can have challenges for that. So, as I say, it's not necessarily for every organisation or even for all of every organisation, but inevitably there will be somewhere it probably works quite well.
The thing about the four-day working week is that it's as much of a construct as the five-day working week. So, I mean, I know economies across the world were vastly different than they are now when weekends were introduced. And still now we have businesses that work across 7 days. So there isn't necessarily an onus on a firm, if the four-day working week doesn't work for them, that they must adopt it.
No, absolutely. And I don't think that would be the intention. I think every organisation needs to adapt to the environment in which they work. And as you quite rightly say, we work in a very global world now, and we have to respond to how our global markets drive business, how they do business, and where we want to compete, and how we want to engage with markets outside of our own necessarily. So we have to be very conscious and cognizant of those. As you quite rightly say, you know, lots of different businesses work in different ways. But when you look perhaps at the sectors that do work 24 hours a day, 7 mm. days a week, 365 days a year, there are very particular issues that arise there. And if we looked maybe specifically at our care sector, we already know that would be hugely challenging. So aside from the administrative cost of managing everybody on a four-day working week type schedule, you would obviously have to be able to replace staff, so you would have to have additional recruitment costs. Those are lend themselves then to further employment costs. But on top of that, we also know that we've got very considerable skills shortages in some of those areas as well. So for some sectors, it's going to be even more complex and challenging than in others. And that's where it starts to become prohibitively expensive, depending on the sector in which you're working.
Are there other areas of flexibility or work-life balance that the government would have been better turning its attention towards at this juncture than a four-day work week?
Well, I think in looking at it, the government have recognised, and I think Taoiseach himself called out in his own comments around this, recognising that all of these challenges exist. And I think it's probably reasonable to look at, you know, where it might be useful, just as we would look at other areas of flexibility. But I do think, you know, we do need to recognise that most employees, and we hear this from employers all of the time, most employees actually need flexibility across all of their working life. You know, their responsibilities outside of work and the balance they need to achieve tends to span the whole working week rather than just one day a week. And so it's really important that we do consider those other flexibilities that people will need beyond perhaps a shorter working week and a longer weekend. And that's going to be really important.
Maeve McElwee, Director of Employer Relations at IBEC, thank you indeed for joining us. WhatsApp her to us here, 0833 97 97 97, saying, Akira, I wonder why some people who got their first vaccine in City West and they've been now told to go to UCD for their second one, but they weren't given reason for this. I've no idea why that would be the case. We'll see if we can find something out. It could be something as simple as vaccine deliveries on a day, as staff availability, but I don't know. We will check it out and get back. While Teresa says, following my interview with John on financial compatibility, she says it's nice for both people to pay and help each other out. She said it would be a better world. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about international travel, the resuming on July 19th, and a national register for defibrillators. Transport Minister is confident that international travel will resume on July 19th as scheduled. That is despite concerns about the Delta variant of COVID-19. Joined on the line now to discuss this by Liam Fanning. He's Professor in Immunovirology and Deputy Head of the Department of Medicine at UCC. Liam, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Do you share Eamon Ryan's optimism?
I do. I think for a long time, you know, Ireland has been kind of slow to adopt some of the key decisions with respect to airline travel. We've seen that Europe is quite open. We've seen that, you know, there's been large sporting events with thousands of people unmasked across Europe. And they're getting to these venues by planes, trains and automobiles. And I think we've been rather slow to take advantage of what is available to us, which is our understanding that antigen tests pick up infectiousness. PCR tests pick up whether you have the virus or not, but oftentimes they're done a couple of days beforehand. So the result is a little bit old by the time you come to the airport. But I do welcome it. I think, you know, their Eamon Ryan is quite correct. We on the 19th of July, we should be able to fully embrace international travel. Clearly, it's much easier if you're vaccinated, Ciara, and doubly vaccinated for those that require two vaccine shots. It gives you the best protection we can possibly give anybody at the moment. So, and for those that are unvaccinated, just please get your testing done in time. Maybe get an antigen test done at the airport. It is expensive. That's the only thing, Ciara.
I think that is a huge, huge barrier for an awful lot of people. They may be absolutely inclined to undergo whatever testing is necessary in order to go wherever they need to go outside of the state, but they may not be able to afford it.
Correct, and I think that's the harsh reality for this year anyway, that international travel will be far more expensive, not because of the price of the flights, but because of the ancillary testing that's required if you're not completely vaccinated. And clearly that brings into into sharp focus the kind of age-based vaccination program we have at the moment. And I think now that we have the over 40s largely done, understanding that there's a group between 60 and 69, I think there's nearly 400,000 with only one shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine, that we should be opening up the portal to everybody. I think this age-based access to vaccine is nearly unethical at this stage, given the fact that we have vaccinated most of the vulnerable. And for those 60 to 69 who would like to travel out of Ireland, give them the Pfizer vaccine. I know if you give to one, you have to take away from another. But at the outset, our vaccination program was clearly set out with the following, that we want to protect the most vulnerable. And we're left in this ironic situation that we have a group of very vulnerable individuals from a COVID perspective vulnerable. And we have a solution in that we could give them the mRNA vaccine as their second shot. And not only will that achieve protection, but it'll give them very good, probably long-term protection, because you've had this mixed vaccine challenge. And the immune system responds very well to the same but slightly different challenges in the context of COVID-19. And they would be wonderfully protected coming into the winter as well. So,
what I find really interesting, Liam, in terms of our discussion of reopening and resuming something approaching normal life, is the vast difference in our discussions, both as a society and among lobby groups and political parties, etc., between the resumption of indoor dining on July 5th as scheduled because of the Delta variant and attitudes to the resumption of international travel on July 19th, also because of the Delta variant.
Now, I suppose the environment within an aircraft is very different to the environment within an indoor restaurant. Now, we'll say, and the air handling and the air changes are very different to what one would have in an indoor dining experience. You know, you've got filtrated air, the air is changed very, very frequently. And plus also you have a situation where individuals are tested before they go into the aircraft.
Mm.
Either they're doubly vaccinated or they produce either a PCR test or an approved antigen test to show that they're not infectious at the time of going into the aircraft. Whereas in a restaurant, if it's an indoor, true indoor experience, you know, where we'll say the doors are closed, it's lashing raining outside, and there isn't sufficient air changes and not sufficient distance between the table, or there's co-mixing between tables, or people are mixing on the way to the toilet and all that kind of thing, you've set up a scenario where individuals can pass infection from one on to the other, and nobody wants that, because A, your 2 weeks are ruined for the next 2 weeks, but
yeah.
You possibly have passed on that infection to somebody who doesn't know that they have a vulnerability which can be exploited by this virus. So they're not quite, I know they appreciate the ball indoor,
yeah.
But the indoor airplane experience is very different to the indoor restaurant experience. And, you know, this indoor-outdoor from a restaurant perspective, we really need to be crisp and clear. Outdoor means outdoor and breezy, as it were, with, you know, full capacity of air to circulate, not sitting behind in an alcove that has no roof on it, you know what I mean? You know, you need, it's about diluting the virus,
mm.
And when it's sunny, the sun, we know, inactivates this virus. So that's why outdoors is better. It's not a carte blanche that you won't get infected outdoors. It's just the risk is less.
So conceivably, and I'm speaking very much in theoretical terms, Liam, it is possible, dependent upon the path of the virus between this week and next, NPHET's recommendations, how government chooses to act upon them, that you and I could take ourselves off on holiday to the south of France on July 19th, but we wouldn't be able to dine indoors at a restaurant in Ireland.
That is very possible. And that's down to, I suppose, you know, you could balance by saying indoor dining could be divided between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, Ciara. So clearly, vaccinated staff, vaccinated customers is very different from a mixed or unvaccinated population. So we've talked previously about the vaccine dividend. I mean, largely at the moment, vaccinated people are living their lives the same way as unvaccinated individuals. In other words, they still have to wear masks. Okay, they can meet a few more individuals indoors. But from a socialization perspective, talk about indoor dining. Their experience is very much the same there. I mean, the vaccinated is very much the same as the unvaccinated. And, you know, we are very much behind taking on board what we see in Europe. You know, outdoor European championships, tens of thousands of people, you know, antigen tested beforehand, they've embraced that fully. You know, if we were having an indoor experience dining, it would have to be supported by robust, well-taken antigen tests and people being honest with respect to mm-hmm. whether they've been vaccinated or not. I know there's been, you know, some chatter about perhaps people presenting vaccination cards that mightn't be fully kosher. I think there were some reports in Dublin Airport of people kind of been taken aside with not having fully kosher vaccination cards.
Oh, I recall that, yeah.
You know, so unfortunately we live in a society, and I know better the societies in Ireland, and sometimes they kind of consider bending the rules quite substantially. And is it fair then to put on the restaurants that they have to police vaccinated versus unvaccinated individuals? I'm only putting that out there as a question because, you know, the eating experience for vaccinated individuals will be totally different. If you could have a full restaurant of vaccinated individuals, it is highly unlikely that any of them will pass on that infection, even if they were infected, because their viral loads or the amount of virus that they have will be less. So therefore, they will be less likely to pass it on, Ciara.
Well, Liam Fanning, Professor in Immunovirology at UCC, thank you indeed, as always, for joining us. Now, there are thousands of defibrillators dotted up and down the country. Where are they, though? Who maintains them? Who has ownership of them? That is what my next guest wants to know. Kildare Labour Senator Mark Wall, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Thank you for having me on.
Delighted to do so. You want to set up a national register, which would be publicly accessible, of defibrillators right across Ireland. What's prompted this?
Yeah, I suppose we were all watching the European Championships last Saturday week, Ciara, when we saw what happened to Christian Eriksen in the Danish match. And you know, it was great to see what has happened since, but the reason that Christian is still alive is the result of an AED and those trained in its use. So that has prompted a lot of people to start talking about where their AED is and, you know, the whole use of defibrillators in this country. And when I started to do some work on this, I've worked with various groups in the past, but when I looked at this in the last week or two, there is no national register of where the location of all our AEDs in the country. Now, these AEDs are located in our sports clubs, they're located in our shops, they're located in our schools, but the national register is lacking. There are a number of initiatives throughout the country. There's a very good one in Enniscorthy in Wexford. There was some great work done in County Leash. I was being made aware of some efforts here in County Kildare as well to register every AED defibrillator. But the issue here is that the Irish Red Cross estimate that we have anything between 8,000 and 10,000 public access defibrillators in Ireland, of which only about 2,000 are actually registered with the National Ambulance Service.
So see, the lack of a registry, Mark, throws up an awful lot of questions, because do we know the groups that are owning, managing and maintaining these defibrillators, quite apart from where they are? And can we be assured that everybody that has access to the ownership, management and maintenance of that defibrillator is enabled and trained to do so?
Yeah, and those are the questions that I've been asking over the last week, and I had a debate with the Junior Minister for Health in the Shannon this week in relation to this exact topic, Ciara. And now he informs me, which is good news, is that in the budget of last year there was €650,000 set aside for this. And there is, the HSE have organised an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest register, and they are working on the idea of having a national register. But again, the problem here is that there are only approximately 2,000 of the AEDs registered out of the 10,000 that are in the country. And just some figures, I suppose, for your listeners. The register records that in 2019, there were 2,564 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. That's 54 for every 100,000 of the population. Mm. So that just shows you the need for this, Ciara. And in 25% of those cases, defibrillation or the use of an AED was actually carried out. So the statistics, unfortunately, will tell us that every minute makes a difference to the survival of the person that's having the cardiac arrest. And that's why we need to know where the AEDs are located, how close they are to the person that's having the cardiac arrest, so the person that's with them or somebody in their community can go and get them. And I just want to mention, I suppose, the most important people in this, as far as I'm concerned, they're our community first responders who are embedded in all our communities. I know, and you would know, Ciara, there's so many great groups here in County Kildare alone, and they're out training every week, and thankfully they're back following the pandemic. They're back out working again. They carry out great work, but they actually have to go out and fundraise themselves. And I'm aware of the local one here in Natoya and others surrounding me, where they have to run something like a table quiz in order to get the money for continuous training and to ensure that their AEDs are up to standard. We should be financing that. This is community health at its best. This is ensuring that we have safe communities. And we're not talking big money. In talking to local community groups, we're only talking about 1,000 or maybe 1,500 euros a year that allows them to, you know, to have that continuous training and ensure that the defibrillators and the pads in our working order.
I would imagine,
so that's the type of money we're talking about.
I would imagine, Mark, that the creation of a register would enable direct central government grants to the individual organisations. In theory, without the need for paperwork, you're registered with us, you're in compliance with everything we've asked you to be in compliance, here's your €1,500. Like, obviously, exactly, it's not going to be that simple, but it should be.
Yeah, well that's the, I think it can be really that simple, Ciara, because these people are actually well organised, the community first responders. Our schools are obviously well organised with our sports clubs. And what we need is a person, maybe, and I'm calling for the community first responders to be that persons in our communities that go around and check. So the community first responders in County Kildare will go around and check the schools and go around and check the sports clubs to ensure those defibs are in working order. That we've had cases, unfortunately, that when the defib went and what was needed, that the pads were not in working order. And that has happened, and there is evidence of that, Ciara, as well, which is very, very unfortunate for the person who's at the end of that cardiac arrest, obviously. So that's what we need. We need to ensure that they're in working order, and we need to have a national register. Most importantly, that the National Ambulance Service, who do terrific work, you know, when you ring that 999 call, They need to know where your nearest DFib is. And we need to know where the other 8,000 approximately DFibs are so they can match that up to where you are. And as I said, every minute saves a life. And that's what we need to do here in Ireland.
Labour Kildare Senator Mark Wall, thank you indeed for joining us. Certainly a very practical call there, and one I think that we could all get on board with in terms of its positive implications across the country. Coming up after the break, we'll be popping back to Kildare Tan and Pat Costello, and we'll talk about more accurate breast cancer testing could be available in under 2 years. Crossing back over to Kildare Tan, where we join Pat Costello and Mr. Jay Crofton.
Yes, indeed. Jay Crofton would be the proper way of saying it. The first time I saw this Mr. Jay Crofton was 1992 when I was doing my first commentaries for the then CKR Radio. He was John Crofton then. Then he changed to Johnny Crofton, and we'll call him Jay. John Crofton, how are you? Johnny Crofton, how are you? We're here at Kildare Builders Providers.
I'm very good, Pat. I'm very, very good.
Now, you're back open fully again. Obviously, there were challenging times over the last 14, 15 months.
Very much so. I think certainly the degree of apprehension that was abroad in February of last year, you know, that will never be forgotten. But we survived and done very well in the interim, and you know, that's thanks to the public, the media, the Kildare Town and all its hinterland, and obviously all of our contractors, subcontractors and the general public.
You have to change your whole business model, really.
Yeah, well, for a couple of months last year, we were deemed, as part of construction, to be closed completely. So we just had a prepaid credit card delivery service, which would only be a fraction of what we normally do. Then when the thing reopened, I mean, it took off, really. And last summer, right through the year, was very, very good. So many people, you know, with the spare money that's well documented at this stage, not so much that it was deliberately saved, but that was... other things couldn't be done. So lots of people have spent money on their gardens and their houses in that period, yeah.
You're open fully now, 6 days a week?
Yeah, we're open from 8 to 5 Monday to Friday and 9 to 1 on a Saturday.
It's the big weekend here, of course, Derby weekend. Much involvement from yourself in that?
Well, we feel like we are. I don't profess to know much about horses, only I love looking at them and I love looking at racing. But thankfully, we're right in the heart of the cream of breeding for flat racing here, and numbered amongst our customers and good customers are the National Stud, Gillangan Stud, quite a number of the really successful trainers, including Mick Halford, Christy Roach, Martin Brazel, Willie McCreary, John Ox, are all locally for us customers of ours.
Yeah, and Willie McCreary, of course, he still could play for Clane, he still could play for Kildare.
Don't answer that.
just in case he's listening, I'm going to say yes.
Speaking of Kildare, obviously you were player, you were manager, you were selector. Some great, great times.
Yeah, some very unforgettable times, certainly from the arrival of Mick O'Dwyer in the county and through his two tenures. I was involved in the playing side in his first tenure, and you know, we got to a National League final, which was a great thing for us at the time. Unfortunately, we didn't win. But the breakthrough and 97 and 98 will certainly stay in my memory. I think lots of, you know, supporters in Kildare will never forget those days.
Well, we won't forget it because we were on the bus that night, travelling from the Johnstown Inn, was it, all the way down to Kildare and back up again. Innocent times maybe, but certainly joyful times.
Yeah, it felt like that bus went for about 5 days after our various buses to different parts of Kildare. So that breakthrough in 98, yeah, joyful times. Innocent times, but hugely enjoyable. And you know, Mikko, at that time, he wanted all of the various communities and the various clubs to partake in that. And you know, there were great days.
Yeah, Jack O'Connor, the current manager, he seems to have the same sort of philosophy. He wants to get the clubs involved as well. Do you see hope for Kildare in now? To the fact that they're back in Division One for 2021 and 2022.
I personally think it's a massive thing that Kildare have regained Division 1 status, and you know, as much as anything from a player point of view, like, it's a huge incentive now for all the young fellas. Like, the fact that we won that All-Ireland Under 20, there is a base of talent from that group and others since that even, and they've shown it already. So you know, to be able to look forward to that, and then from the management point of view, from a supporter point of view, it's just to be able to look forward to playing the, you know, the Dublins, the Kerrys, the Tyrones, the Donegals. And I'm sure from a corporate point of view, even from the point of view of the whole area of finance, which is so important now for teams and structures in the GAA to be successful, it's all good.
And from a business point of view, from the likes of you here at Kildare Billet Providers, it's a boost as well. People get a lift from when their county does well.
Ah, there's no doubt, and I've had great support here, and the lads here, all of our staff here, like some of them are involved with clubs, and on the local scene here, you know, Rathangan, Ellistown, Monaster Evans, Suncroft, Nerney, and not to leave out our old friends Moorfield,
and I'm going to say Sarsfields.
And Sarsfields, like, and you know, the GAA fraternity, it's a community in its own right, and the banter and crack we have in here, and there is great, you know, partisanship club-wise apart, like some of my best customers genuinely are Moorfield guys.
Yeah, well, like Willie McCreary, John, you looked as if you could still play for Sarsfields. I saw maybe you were playing for the B team at one stage, but for the moment, you still work here at Kildare Builders Providers.
If there was a team going out in the morning, I'd like to think, if Willie was on it, he'd be full forward. I think I go better in the middle of the field than he did, and he's dead. That's just looking at him now.
You'd keep dropping the ball into him. That's Johnny Crofton, John, who is here at Kildare Billet Providers. John, thank you for talking to us, and the very best of luck for the future.
Thank you very much, Pat.
There we go. We're heading back into the town again, and we'll be meeting the man from Silk and Thomas very shortly.
Great stuff, and Pat will be checking back in with Ben and Paul a little later on the programme. And joined now on the line by very patient Professor William Gallagher. He's director of the UCD Conway Institute of Biomolecular and Biomedical Research. William, you're very welcome to the programme.
Yeah, thanks very much, Ciara.
You and your colleagues have been conducting some research in conjunction with the Royal College of Surgeons and Oncomark Limited, and you have come up with a significantly more accurate way of testing for breast cancer, and it could be available in under 2 years.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, this is a study, what we could call a clinical validation study, where we worked with 11 hospitals around Ireland, and we studied over 400 patient samples, and the particular focus was on patients with early stage breast cancer. So I suppose the good thing about screening improvements in kind of screening for breast cancer is we're catching breast cancer at a much earlier level, such that, you know, before the disease has spread around different parts of the body. So that's great in terms of, you know, early detection, but it presents a challenge in terms of what you do. You know, obviously you can remove the breast tumor, but the decision is what additional treatments should you give that person. And, you know, the most common form of breast cancer, it's what's called hormone receptor positive breast cancer, where patients would be given hormone therapy, and that's very effective for about a period of 5 years. But the key question is, should you also give chemotherapy? And, you know, we're all familiar with the kind of potential side effects with chemotherapy, you know, vomiting, hair loss, etc. You know, it's not very nice thing to have to be given, but, you know, we have to really try to understand, can we identify the patients which potentially may require chemotherapy versus those that don't. So our test can actually be used to really, I suppose, identify those patients up front.
And that would mean more effective treatment for those patients that do require chemotherapy, and I suppose the freedom of knowing that if you're a patient that does not require chemotherapy, that you won't have to have it.
I think it's more the latter, really. It's really providing the comfort that you don't, you know, in the vast majority of cases, at least over two-thirds of those cases, of patients with early stage breast cancer, they don't really have any benefit from chemotherapy. They can do perfectly well with hormone therapy alone. And again, our study would look over a particularly long period, maybe up to 10 years post-treatment. And the idea is, you know, can they be spared that kind of side effects associated with chemotherapy? So it's really that sparing the effects of chemotherapy and really just giving it to the patients that potentially stand to benefit from that.
Because as you've said, William, like the effects differ to a degree from person to person, and it can be incredibly harsh on the body.
Yeah, and I think that's a challenge is, you know, classical chemotherapy, what you're probably trying to do is, you know, you're trying to get rid of the tumour, you know, the tumour cells that are floating around the body. And then, unfortunately, the nature of chemotherapy is that it also has these kind of effects on normal cells in the body, on, you know, the cells in your gut and your hair follicles, you know. So you have all of these indirect side effects. Now, there is a move towards more what are called targeted treatments, more selective treatments, and breast cancer has led the way in that context, you know, where you can actually precisely identify a more effective, more subtle treatment in a targeted way. But we're still quite reliant on chemotherapy, still in breast cancer.
What happens now, William? How does will your study translate to patients and clinicians?
So I suppose a good thing is that these types of tests are already used. So, you know, Ireland, you know, it's quite interesting, even during the kind of economic challenges that we faced, I think it was 2011, there was a kind of an earlier test that was developed called Oncotype DX, where essentially all patients in that kind of scenario of early stage breast cancer, which are hormone receptor positive, you know, if the oncologist and the patient decide, can actually get this test performed. And it's a pretty good test. I suppose what our study has shown that we've developed an improved, more accurate test in that scenario. So this original test has kind of three categories, you know, where it defines patients as low risk, high risk, but they have this unfortunate grey zone in the middle, and they don't really know what to do with it, whereas our test really has a yes-no type of decision. And also it can be performed in kind of local hospitals as opposed to, you know, maybe sending samples to the US for analysis with the current test, and have potentially a quicker turnaround rather than waiting a week or 2 weeks. And obviously patients, you know, have a lot of anxiety while they're waiting for that decision to come back, whereas potentially you can turn it around in, you know, 1 or 2 days within a local hospital.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, so I suppose what we've done now is we've taken it to a certain point where we've actually done a series of different clinical studies from patient samples and patients within Ireland, Austria and the UK. So, you know, all of those studies have shown very positive results. So the next stage is now to kind of go through the kind of regulatory path to actually get out there into a clinical environment. And that probably takes, you know, between 1 to 2 years to do that. But, you know, the data is very solid at the moment. I would be quite optimistic that it would get out there into, you know, being able to use for patients on a day-to-day basis.
And that would feel very quick, but of course this study has taken a considerable time to come to this point.
Yeah, it's taken about 8 years, I'd say, to get to this point. You know, the original work was carried out in my academic lab in collaboration with colleagues in Trinity College Dublin. And, you know, we did a lot of kind of early discovery work, and then we kind of worked with a spin-out company, Oncomark, to actually develop that into a standardized format of a test that could be applied within a clinical environment. And that's the test that was used for those validation studies. And then it needs to kind of go to that next level, and in terms of, I suppose, mainstreaming the assay and getting it out there into a clinical environment. So, you know, I think, you know, hopefully it wouldn't be too long, you know, in terms of development, but certainly a lot of the kind of groundwork has been done.
Well, Professor William Gallagher, Director of the UCD Conwy Institute of Biomolecular and Biomedical Research, thank you indeed for joining us.